I'm going to discuss tonight the subject of Kabbalah. And I know that that's a subject where there is a tremendous amount of misunderstanding. And I would like to try to clear up some of the points. I'm going to start with something from this past week's reading. Okay, if you remember, there's two tragic incidents in the Torah, one right next to the other. I'm speaking about Numbers 11, chapter 11, and it says that the Numbers chapter 11 starts off in verse 1, and the nation was complaining. They were bad in the eyes of God, and then the fire came, and Moses prayed to God, and the fire ceased. And they called this place Tav Era, which comes from the word fire. Okay, then right afterwards, the Torah tells a story about the those that among the nation that had were overcome with a desire for food. Okay, and then complained about the manna because they complained that it was tasteless, that it didn't have actually it had a taste of like wafers and honey, but the Talmud explains that it did not have any eye appeal. And there's a tremendous psychological enjoyment in food, that's eye appeal. And the manna didn't have any eye appeal, so therefore it wasn't fully satisfying from a psychological standpoint, and they suddenly had to overcome with a desire for flesh. So then Moses complained to God about the fact that he can't continue to assume this responsibility for these people. He said, where can I get meat to feed them? And then God said to him that, tell the nation, and this is in 11, verse 18, tell the nation, get ready tomorrow, and you're going to eat meat. And God is going to give you meat, and you're going to eat it. You won't have it for one day, not for 5 days, but for an entire month, until it comes out of your noses, and it'll be something that will be disgusting for you. In other words, you'll be sick of it. And then Moses says the strangest thing, and that is in verse 21. So it says, Moses says, this nation is 600,000 people, that I am in its midst, and you say to them that I will give them flesh, and they will eat. They'll eat for a month's time. So Moses says to God, he says, are there sheep and cattle that are going to be slaughtered for them? Are all the fish of the sea going to be gathered up for them? How are you going to do this? So then God replies, and he says to Moses, he says, are you cutting short the hand of God? You will see whether what I say will happen or not. Okay? So here is this little dialogue between Moses and God. And Moses says to God, that what are you saying? There's 600,000 people here, and you say that you're going to give them meat for a month's time. Where are they going to get this meat from? There's no. Are you going to have all the fish of the sea gathered up to them, or the cattle and sheep? So God says to Moses, Are you saying that the hand of God is incapable, is weak, incapable of doing that? You'll see if what I'm saying is going to happen or not. Okay? And then it says, then the Torah, there's an interspersing here of two different topics, which I'm not going to go into why that is, but it comes back to the storyline in verse 30, where it says Moses went to the camp, he and the elders of Israel, and then it says, and a wind came, and took these birds from the ocean, and they in fact did fall on the camp. Okay, what is outstanding in this little chapter? answer here is that Moses questions God. Moses says to God, how are you going to do this? And God says to him, what do you mean? Are you saying the arm of God is incapable? You saying God is weak, that he's unable to do this? Now, the question, the obvious question, of course, is that Moses was the one who had just taken the people out of Egypt with all the plagues, all the miracles, the splitting of the sea, and the giving of the Torah at Sinai, and suddenly, for a few quail, he thinks that God can't do it. I mean, a child wouldn't ask such a question. And here's the great Moses, the man that knew God face to face, the man that's on the highest level. He asked this question, and God says to him, "Are you saying that the hand of God is short? Are you shortening the hand of God, God's power? I mean, what kind of a question did Moses ask? I mean, this is astonishing. Okay. Anybody want to suggest an answer? But everybody see the question? Okay. The question is a very powerful one. It's unintelligible. A man that has gone through all these miracles and has seen the hand of God in the highest degree, how can he ask a question, how can God bring quail? Okay? It just doesn't make any sense. Okay. But I think that in this little dialogue lies a very important principle. Now let's make recourse to another verse in the Torah. Can we go back to the miracles in Egypt? All right? We find that the Torah expresses itself several times in an elaborate manner, which we really don't understand the need for this elaboration. Let me give you an example. You have the plague of the blood, okay? Then you have the frogs, and then you have the lice. And then you have, after that you have, you have the wild animals, okay? Then you have the pestilence. Then you have the plague with the boils, okay? And then you have the plague of the locusts, all right? Now, in the plague of the locusts, it says that, you have the plague after the boils, you have the plague of the, you have the barad, which is the plague of the lightning and the hailstones, okay? And then after that you have the plague of the locusts, grasshoppers, okay? Now, when the Torah speaks about the plague of the grasshoppers, of the locusts, so it says, and this is in Exodus 10:12, it says, and God said to Moses, stretch your hand out on the land of Egypt with the locusts, and they shall go forth on the land of Egypt, and they shall eat every grass of the land, every grass land, everything that the hurricane, you know, the previous plague, which was the hurricane and the thunder and lightning, everything in the hailstones, everything that destroyed, the locusts are going to completely consume. So it says in verse 13, Exodus 10:13, and Moses stretched his hand in the land of Egypt, and God caused a wind to blow over that entire night, that entire day and that night, and the eastward wind carried the locusts. Okay. Now, what was the need? What is the need for the Bible to tell us, for the Torah to tell us, that this wind carried the locusts? I mean, what do we care really? What brought them there? All it had to say was that the locusts simply descended on the land of Egypt. I mean, that's enough. As a matter of fact, the wind bringing it really detracts from the miracle. It would have been more astounding to say, well, the locusts just came and they just descended. But no, the Torah makes a point of mentioning that the locusts were driven by this eastward wind. Okay? The question is, why? Why does the Torah do that? But the answer, I think, in the answer, contains one of the principles of Torah. And that is that when the Torah tells us the story of the creation, what the Torah is telling us is that God created the world in 6 days. The seventh day was a day of rest. And after that, these laws of nature are fixed. That was the only time that there was a creation process. What philosophers refer to as creatio ex nihilo, which means creation from nothing. But after that time, God does not create anything from nothing. And any intervention, anything that takes place on this world, which is a miracle, is really essentially a timing miracle, but the timing is the essence of the miracle, and anything that's done in the miracle is always through the laws of nature. That's why the Torah is telling us by the Arba that the wind brought the Arba, brought the locust. The reason why the Torah tells us that is the Torah does not want us to believe or to think for a moment that God simply produced these locusts just from thin air. All right? Because that would be against God's way, and that would be against God's principles, and against the idea of creation. So, since the time of creation, God does not produce things from nothing. In other words, nothing in the world is ever produced ex nihilo. Okay? Anything that God directs in this world is always through his laws of nature, and is never through a violation of those laws. That's an important principle. Now we can understand the dialogue between Moses and God. What Moses said to God was, you don't produce anything from nothing, so you're never going to produce quail from thin air. That's not something that he knew. See, a child wouldn't ask that question, because a child that doesn't know anything, everything is possible. But Moses, who knew God, who knew God's ways, he knew that God doesn't do such a thing. So therefore he said to God, how is it possible to give these people quail if there are no quail in sight, and you're not going to produce them just from thin air, because that's against your principles? So then God said to him, are you shortening the hand of God, meaning to say that my system, God says, my system of nature is more complex than you imagine. And in truth, there is nothing impossible to bring quail. It's not impossible to bring quail without producing them from thin air. But actually, it is possible through natural means to bring them, and that's exactly what God did. And that's why the verse says that, again, it was the wind that brought the quail. Now, the dialogue, we don't understand exactly, precisely, Moses' question and God's response, and what terms it took with more precision, because that was a dialogue between God and Moses. But what we can understand is the gist of the dialogue, the outline of the dialogue. And the dialogue, the reason why Moses raised the question was, according to Moses' understanding of nature, it was impossible to produce these quail unless they were produced out of thin air. And that's a violation of God's laws. And God doesn't do that. And that's why he said, how is it possible? God answered him, no, your understanding of nature is at a loss in this case. You think it's much simpler than it is. And by doing that, you're shortening the hand of God, so to speak. In other words, you're assuming it's more simplistic than God's real way. And that's why God says, no, you will see. As a matter of fact, that's what God meant to when he said to Moses, that you will see if it will occur. Now, Nachmanides points out that word, will occur, is a word that has to do with coincidence. An occurrence, a coincidental occurrence, meaning to say that God said to Moses, you will see whether the laws of nature are capable in this instance that you think it's impossible. You will see whether that is true or not. In other words, God was showing Moses something about the laws of nature that he didn't know before, and that additional knowledge about the system of nature quite possible for these quail to be brought into the camp. Okay? Now we understand the dialogue. And this is pretty clear. I mean, I think it's pretty clear to anyone that just uses their intelligence in analyzing these verses. Now, you'll ask me, okay, fine. So God does not destroy his laws, and anything that's done is always done within the framework of the laws of the 7 days of creation, 6 days of creation. Now, the rabbis of the Talmud always understood it that way, and there's a Mishnah about that, and it's mentioned in several places. For instance, by Jonah, when it says that God appointed a whale. I mean, I'm sorry, a big fish. Excuse me. God appointed a big fish. So the Talmud says that this fish, which means when God appointed this fish, the Talmud says, this fish was appointed on the 6 days of creation. You see, meaning to say that this was not an ordinary fish, because a person, a human being, could not survive in the body of a whale. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the Monkey Trial, you know, the famous movie. The name escapes right now. But in the head, Clarence Darrow, who was questioning the fellows running for president. Name escapes me. I'm bad with names. But he was a religionist, and he questioned him. He said, "How is it possible for Jonah to live in a whale's stomach? A person would be consumed in a whale's stomach by the gastric juices."
Rabbi.
Yes.
That was the Scopes trial, and that was just across the river from Athens.
Really?
In Dayton, Tennessee. Yes.
Oh wow, that is something.
Next time you're down here, we'll take you to the courthouse.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
Okay.
was it James Bryant? Bryant was the name.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. But
Williams Jennings Bryant.
Williams Jennings Bryant. Right?
There you go.
He was a candidate for the presidency at one time, right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So you take care of the Talmud, and I'll get you the historical stuff.
Right.
Okay, but that's the Scopes trial in Dayton.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
That's right.
Dayton, Tennessee.
Tennessee. Wow.
Okay.
Great. So at any rate, so William Jennings Bryant. He found himself at a loss to answer the question. So he said, well, God could do anything, you see. He did not have the Masorah, you know, the tradition from Sinai. No, that is not true. The Talmud states explicitly that fish was not an ordinary fish. It was appointed from the time of creation, which means when God created the world, that specific fish was programmed into the creation, and in that fish, Jonah was able to survive. But in an ordinary fish, he would not be able to survive. And that, in general, is the rabbis of the Talmud make a very strong point out of that in many, many places. And they say that the miracles in Egypt and the staff of Moses, all those things came from the 6 days of creation. And therefore, they were not exceptions to the laws of nature. Now, the rabbis had no motive to say that. On the contrary, if you want to get people to be religious, most people will be much more effective to tell them, hey, God just does anything. God just does all the primitive religions always say, all the man-made religions always say that. God can do anything. And here the Torah is unique, that the rabbis went out of their way to say, no, God does not do anything. God has a system. He works with a system, and God loves his laws. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says, the Medrash says that when it says, God says, and I went down to take them out of Egypt, so the Medrash comment says that was coming down means it was something not something that God really totally was happy with, okay, so to speak, all right? When we speak about God, we have to use certain phrases, but we know that they're human terms, but it's the only way we can express it. So the Talmud says, that God said, I went down. Going down means something that's not good. There's an implication there that God was not happy with the whole thing of the miracles. Okay? Now, you'll say, so what do I really care? I mean, most people say, well, look, I'd be happier if God would just do all these miracles. And what do I care? Okay, so he doesn't do it. Well, what difference does it make to me? Personally, and everything in the Torah has to have also reflect or have an effect on our personal perfection as well in our personal life. We have many, many beautiful philosophical ideas, But as Rabbi Soloveitchik said, every philosophical idea has to have some kind of practical benefit for us in our lives, in our personal lives. And I believe that the over here, there is a great benefit. And the benefit is really the whole approach of Torah. And that, and it differs completely from the approach of the man-made religions. And that is that we do not believe in escapism and fantasy and trying to get away from the laws of nature. On the contrary, we say that is life's challenge. That's what God wants us to do. And by knowing the fact that even God does not break those laws after the 6 days of creation, and that everything is, and that He, His will is that these laws should never be broken, that teaches us the fact that we too should really have a love for the laws of nature and a respect for them, and a realization that our challenge in life is not to look for miracles and breaches, but on the contrary, to look to the world that we find ourselves with in, and to try to perfect ourselves and use our divine element, and that's really the challenge of life, to use our divine element and interact with God's beautiful system. Okay? That's what the Torah really teaches us, and that is a dialogue between Moses and God. It's a very important principle in Torah, and it goes contrary to all the man-made religions, because of course the Torah is the religion of truth. Now, what I'd like to say is that these Kabbalah people, okay, the mystics that you find today, go completely in the opposite direction. What they are trying to preach is escapism, completely the opposite of what the Torah really teaches. I had a call not too long ago from a woman. She lived, I believe, in North Carolina, and she had heard about me through a certain Rosh Yeshiva. And she was a physician, graduated Harvard University and Harvard Medical School, and she thought she wanted to discuss with me certain ideas in philosophy. And she mentioned to me that she wants to discuss the transmigration of the souls. So, in other words, that means that a soul of A can later find itself in the soul of B. Okay? So, she thought it was a wonderful, a very wonderful philosophy and idea, and definitely a Torah idea without any question. And she felt that all the souls, that no new souls are created today, and every soul we have today is comes from a former life. And she had this whole, she went on about this whole thing. She asked me what I thought about it. So I told her, I said, look, I said, this sounds like a very important principle, if it's true. So she said, oh, no doubt. I said, you know, it sounds so important that that would be something that would really change a person's entire outlook about Torah. She said, definitely that is so. I said, it is something which would really affect the very core of the way I serve God. She said, absolutely without a question. I said, well, then how come there is not one verse in the entire Torah that tells us this wonderful principle? Okay? Now, the thing is that people will always try to convince you about certain things, and the source for their conviction really is purely in their minds, and it's purely a psychological phenomenon, and yet they are very convinced about it. What they try to do is to project it onto God's Torah. But no one can do such a thing if they are really honest and have some intelligence, because anyone can see right away that the Torah states straightforward the major principles of its system, and one of them is not transmigration of the souls. So obviously, even if someone should say that there is such a thing, it certainly plays no role in terms of my worship of God and in terms of the basic fundamental principles of Torah. Now, it just so happens that scholars have commented on this, and Sanji Goen, who is one of the greatest scholars, mentions this this concept, transmigration of souls, and he refers to it as metempsychosis. That's what they call it. And he says that He says, and I'm quoting from, it's in On the Soul, Chapter 8. He says, "Yet I must say that I have found certain people who call themselves Jews professing the doctrine of metempsychosis, which is designated by them as the theory of the transmigration of souls. What they mean thereby is that the spirit of Reuben is transferred to Simon and afterwards to Levi and after that to Judah. Many of them would even go so far as to assert that the spirit of a human being might enter into the body of a beast, or that of a beast into the body of a human being, and other such nonsense and stupidities." And he goes on saying how foolish these people are and how nonsensical this is, and of course he shows certain verses which they think state this principle and how they completely misunderstand these verses. And he says, as a matter of fact, it is such a that is such a ridiculous idea that the only reason he's writing about it is because people actually happen to believe it. He has to address the issue, but basically he dismisses it as total stupidity. Now, there's another problem that we encounter if we accept these mystical approaches. And that is that the Torah tells us distinctly not to follow the ways of all these nations that, that God is going to drive out of the land of Israel and all the surrounding nations in the world. The Torah is very careful and repeats that several times, not to follow the ways of the other nations. Now, we know that the other nations all have this kind of worship. Okay? It's all there. The transmigration of souls is found in the most primitive religions of man. Now, it was very strange indeed to say that the Torah should endorse and embrace something which the Torah itself says you should not follow. In other words, how is it possible that this type of a thing should be something the Torah would want and would endorse if the Torah says it shouldn't follow the ways of the Goyim? This is precisely the ways of all the primitive nations. Okay? Now, of course, you know, people that have these opinions, it's very hard to shake them of their beliefs because it's not based on any kind of rationality or any kind of thought process, but it's based upon the same emotions that cause the primitive people to believe it. Now, when people resort to such things, many times they have psychological problems and they're trying to escape them through these through these kind of beliefs. Sometimes it does help them to some extent to at least stay within a certain realm of reality, but we're not talking about therapy over here. We're talking about what is true. We're talking about a normal person that wants to know what the truth is in God's world, and that is definitely not so. Okay, so but at any rate, these people try to answer this question. They try to say that maybe the answer is very simple. The Torah really believes in all these things, and the other nations got it from the people of Israel. Now, I say that that idea is intrinsically absurd, but certainly today we know it's factually absurd, because we know through history that these primitive people have these ideas all the way back, even predating the Torah, the same ideas and the same nonsense. And if you look at the Torah itself, you never find a single verse in the Torah that conforms or encourages or endorses that kind of thinking. It just is not there. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite is always there, that the Torah outlaws, it prohibits sorcery and superstition and all the and searching for the dead, trying to communicate with the dead, and trying to find out the future, all these things that are at the very heart and core of the primitive mind, the Torah prohibits very strictly. It's pretty obvious to anyone who reads the Torah with an open mind that these things are evil in the eyes of the Torah. So what I'd like to do now is go into the question of Kabbalah. Is there a... Yet we do hear the word Kabbalah, all right? And we hear people claim that books are written on Kabbalah. Sholom wrote a famous book on, very famous his writings in Kabbalah, many books he wrote. And the world seems to be very excited. Now, what I want to show you is that there is absolutely no such thing, and that anyone that tells you that there is such a thing is a fraud. All right? So you'll say to me, well, 1 second, how could that be? Isn't there a Zohar? Aren't those Kabbalistic writings? And don't people say that the Zohar is authentic? Well, it's a big argument about whether the Zohar is authentic. It wasn't. It was discovered in the 13th century, and we don't know really whether it is authentic. There are scholars that say it is authentic, scholars say it isn't authentic. But I say, regardless, even if we should say it is authentic, I still maintain that there is no such thing as Kabbalistic writings of any kind that are extant today. All right? Okay. You'll say, well, how could that be? Okay. I'm going to show you how that is and why it must be so. All right? Now, I'm reading from Maimonides, his introduction to his third book of the guide. Okay? Now, he says like this. He says that it has been shown. He talks about the knowledge of the divine chariot, which is certainly secretive knowledge, although not what people believe today, what they call Kabbalah. Okay, it's something completely different. What it means is there are matters, as Maimonides said, they have stated, the rabbis have stated, that the divine chariot includes matters too deep and too profound for the ordinary intellect. That is certainly so. That there are, that in Torah there are profound secrets which an ordinary intellect cannot fathom and should not try to fathom and is not on a level to attempt to understand those things. And if they do, it will only be harmful. Okay, because they're going to get false notions in the area. And of course, that has to do with the study of God. Okay. Now, Maimonides states, it has been shown that a person favored by providence with reason to understand these mysteries is forbidden by the law to teach them except viva voce, that means face to face, and on condition that the pupil possess certain qualifications, and even then, only the heads of the sections may be communicated. Okay, now that is authentic, because that is a Mishnah in the Tractate of Chagiga. Okay, so people forget, you know, they start questioning whether the Zohar is authentic. The Mishnah, nobody questions its authenticity. Everyone knows it's authentic. So there the Mishnah states clearly that one who has the profound knowledge of the secrets of Torah, all right, is not permitted to communicate these secrets except by way of mouth and on the condition that the pupil possesses certain qualities, and even then only the heads of the sections can be communicated. Okay? It is clear, you see, that these things are not permitted to be written down, certainly not written down. They can't even be expressed except under certain conditions. Now, Maimonides continues, this has been the cause why the knowledge of this mystery has entirely disappeared from our nation, and nothing has remained of it. Okay? This was unavoidable, for the explanation of these mysteries was always communicated, viva voce. It means by way of mouth. It was never committed to writing. Okay? Now, Maimonides continues, and he says, if that's the case, how can I expound on these profound mysteries? And Maimonides explains that, first of all, he says he does not have any Kabbalah. Oh, by the way, what does Kabbalah mean? Kabbalah means received. It means the word Kabbalah comes from the concept that there must be a verbal reception, which means received by person, from person to person. We call it ish mipiish, man from the mouth of a man, which means one person communicates directly, verbally, to the other individual. Now, I want you to understand something. This is Maimonides talking. He's talking about one of the greatest scholars in Israel. And I want to make this clear that although the Talmud itself was never supposed to be committed to writing, as you know, but we know the Talmud was committed to writing. But that is a completely different situation than the mysteries, the profound mysteries of Torah. And I'll explain to you why. There is nothing harmful in the Talmud for any person, anyone. There's nothing harmful in the Talmud. Therefore, the Talmud, the reason why it was not supposed to be written down is a completely different reason why it wasn't supposed to be written down. The reason is because the Torah system, the Torah has to guard its system. There have always been people that have impostors that have presented themselves to the masters, to people as the masters of the Torah. Okay? And they aren't. And they're impostors. Phonies. Frauds. Now, the way the Torah safeguarded the system was by not having it written down. Because when something's written down, then people say, well, we have the same books. We'll explain it differently. Okay? That's why writing down the Bible, it was a sad time and it was a fast day. Because they said this is a tragedy. What's a tragedy? When they wrote down the Septuagint. The tragedy is, well, now everybody's going to claim that they understand the Bible too. And that's exactly what happened to the world. That was a tragedy of Christianity. So translating the Bible was itself considered a tragic event. And the same thing, and that's why the Talmud was not supposed to be written down, because then everyone claims they're an authority even though they aren't. And the masses are fooled because they say, well, we read the Talmud too. They don't understand the Talmud. You can show, and a scholar could demonstrate to you that these people have no knowledge of the Talmud, but the average person doesn't know. He goes into his house, he sees the Talmud there, he sees the Talmud in the Orthodox rabbi's house. Oh, they both have Talmud, they both know Talmud. That's the way the average person thinks, not on too deep a level. And because of that, the Torah becomes misrepresented and people are misguided. That's one consideration, but it's not a harmful content, okay? There's nothing harmful in the Talmud. All right, except it's going to be misunderstood. But the area of the profound secrets is a dangerous area. That's why even when it's communicated by way of mouth, it only can be communicated under certain very strict situation. In other words, you can only do it to a very special individual who has reached a certain level. And then you can't even tell him the entire thing. Only the heads of the chapters, which means it's something which the person must already be on the trail of these ideas. And you can give him the heads of the chapters so he could know whether he's traveling in the right sphere. But you can't talk to him anything more about that because you might tell him something that he's not ready for. And if he misconstrues that, then we have the greatest danger of the Torah, which is to misconstrue the idea of God. It is much better, far better, for a person not to attempt to understand God than to attempt to understand God and misunderstand Him. That was the story with the elders of Israel when they saw God, it says next verse, and they saw the God of Israel, and they ate and they drank. Then they were deserving of death. Why? Because they had an imperfect vision of God. Okay, there was an imperfect. They saw in God something which was not correct. And what they saw in God was they thought that God changes in a sense, like in time, like at one time is this way, another time is that way. And that of course is a defect in one of the 13 principles of our faith. Talmud and the Torah is always very cautious. That's why around the mountain of Sinai, you had different. There were set up different groups. In other words, there was different circles around the mountain, and Moses was closer than Aaron than the Levites to show that a person cannot approach God without proper preparation, and then only with great caution. So that's why these profound mysteries are not for everyone, because the average person is going to misconstrue it, and then once he does that, he distorts his ideas of God. That is the worst horror that can happen to him. So, for instance, that's why this was never permitted to be communicated, except in a certain circumstance, because it's very harmful. Now, you understand yourself, that being the case, it could never be written down. It's impossible to write it down. You aren't even allowed to express it to the one person who is an outstanding individual. Even that person, you can only speak about the heads of the chapters. So it is intrinsically harmful, and it's intrinsically prohibited to write this down, and it never could have been written down, never was written down. Okay? This is the Talmud, Maimonides, the Mishnah. We're talking about authentic material. Therefore, I say to you that it is impossible that Simon Bar Yochai could have written down these things. He never would write these things down because it's not permissible to write it down. Now, Ramban has an interesting an interesting position. Okay, Maimonides says that the this tradition is gone. So there is absolutely no such thing as Kabbalah. Cannot be such a thing. It's completely impossible. Okay. Now Nachmanides, okay, as you know, is a great scholar. Not as great as Maimonides. He himself did not consider himself as great as Maimonides, but he was nevertheless a great scholar and in the same league, so to speak, as Maimonides. Now he had a different view, okay. And every Kabbalist will always try to say, if you mention Maimonides, say, well, Nachmanides differs from him. He believed in Kabbalah. Okay, that is true in a certain sense, but these people again fail to investigate their sources. What they do is anything that's in line with their emotions, they immediately seize on and say, oh, there, you see, that's the way it is. Just like Christians will do with regard to Jesus and the five books of Moses and the prophets. Anything they say, oh, that's him. You see, there he is over there. That's the same thing that these people do. People that are driven by emotion always do that. Now, Nachmanides, in his commentary on the Torah, he has Kabbalistic secrets. Okay? Now, he maintains, all right, that he received the true tradition from Ish Mipi Ish, which means a man from the mouth of another man, verbal transmission. And his rabbi was, actually two rabbis, was Rabbi Ezra and Rabbi Israel from Gerona, and then they go back to their rabbi, and until they come to the son of the Ravad, Rabbid, famous Rabbad, and then it goes back even further. I mean, we know several generations, okay, that it goes back to. And therefore, Nachmanides claimed that these people had the authentic Kabbalah, and he had learned it from them. And he wrote in his commentary to the Bible. He writes there are two parts to his explanations. One part is the rational part, where he explains what happened, what occurred. And Nachmanides is a great genius, great mind, very rational person. And then he has another part where he has secrets. These secrets of the Torah. Now, of course, let me just give you at this point a little bit of an introduction. All right? I want to digress just for a second. The Talmud tells us a story in Chagiga. It's an interesting story about this, about the Kabbalah. And the Talmud says as follows, that Rabbi Yochanan said to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yochanan said, he said to this student of his, he says, come, I will teach you the secrets of the divine chariot. Divine chariot, it means the profound secrets of Torah. So he answered him, Rabbi Elazar responded, he said, no, he says, I'm not old enough. Okay? And then what happened was Rabbi Yochanan passed away. So then Rabbi Asi came over and he said to him, he told him, I'll teach you the divine secrets. So he answered him, he said, if I was fortunate, I would have learned it from your rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan. But at that time, he refused, he declined. But now it's too late, because Rabbi Yochanan passed away. So apparently he knew that the greater the person, the greater the knowledge. But the point I want to make here is a very simple point. Now you're talking about great scholars, true scholars. Now, what was Rabbi Elazar's response when Rabbi Yochanan came over to him and said, come, I'm going to teach you the secrets, the most profound secrets of Torah, things that no one knows? What would anyone's response be? When can we start? I'll start tonight. I'll be up all night. I won't stop. This is like what I've been waiting for all my life. What did Rabbi Elazar, the true scholar, say? He said, no, I'm not old enough. I'm not ready. What does that show us? It shows us a very simple thing. It shows us how far we are from even being in the range of these secrets, okay? Because the great scholar, Rabbi Elazar, he said he's not ready. Now, why did he say that? The answer is most people are not only not ready, they're just basically rooted in primitive emotion and curiosity. And they don't even know their own shortcomings. They don't even know, they can't even tell their own, they have no concept of their own limitations. if you would tell someone, look, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to explain to you what an angel is, what an angel means. Yeah, I'm ready. Say, well, maybe you're not ready. Nah, don't worry. I can understand everything. People do not even have their limitations in sight. They're not even in sight of their own limitations. They don't know what that means even. Anyone who does not know, does not have a concept of their own limitations, and that takes a tremendous amount of self-knowledge, a person that doesn't have that is not even in the range, not even the ballpark of understanding the profound mysteries of Torah. They don't understand themselves, okay? The true scholar is like the Talmud explains, the person who knows their limitations and who will turn down the opportunity to engage in these profound mysteries because the person knows they aren't ready. Then you see you're dealing with an individual who is in reality and who is dealing with knowledge, knowledge of himself, okay, which is primary, and that's really where Torah perfection lies. So you see from this little anecdote that the Talmud brings down, just gives you an idea of how out of range the people today are who want to get involved in the profound mysteries. They don't even, they could not even follow a simple Talmudic text that had to do with halacha, because it is too complicated, they could not follow it. Now, how can anyone that can't even follow the most simple Talmudic text be able to engage in these profound mysteries which are beyond the range of the ordinary intellect, the ordinary perfected intellect, okay? So you see, it's very silly. When you have a man like Sholem writing on Kabbalah, it's absolute nonsense. You could be sure of that. Because if he's talking about Kabbalah that the Talmud is referring to, you can't even begin to think about such a thing until you've mastered the Talmud, until you're able to follow the most abstract and most refined point in Torah learning. Okay? Now, I mean, Talmud learning is not an easy matter. I mean, it's something which takes years to master. I gave a class, which I give once a year, we delve very deeply into a specific portion of the Talmud. And many of the fellows in the yeshiva just went out after the first lecture. They left. They just said, look, we can't follow. Okay? And now you're just dealing with, not with any kind of profound mysteries, what is supposed to be commonplace in this. You understand what I mean? Which is supposed to be, I don't mean commonplace in terms of human beings, but in the Beis HaMedrash, in the house of learning, this is considered something which is basic, okay? If you can't get the basics, you certainly aren't ready for profound mysteries. So when you read a man like Sholem, who was an ignoramus in Talmud, he's going to explain to you about Kabbalah, it's total nonsense. It's charlatanism. It cannot be accurate. Not if he's talking about the Kabbalah from the greats of the Talmud. I mean, you can make up your own Kabbalah, but it's not the Kabbalah of the Talmud. Now let's get back to Nachmanides. Now, Nachmanides, where I just read to you that Maimonides says that there is no trace left of the authentic understanding of the mysteries, profound mysteries of Torah among the nation, Nachmanides had a different view, and Nachmanides maintained that he received the secrets of Torah from scholars, his teachers, and they in turn from other teachers going all the way back to the time of the Talmud. Okay. Now, Nachmanides, as I said, in his commentary, he does mention, sometimes you'll see, quite often, they'll say, and now he's going to, one of the secrets of the Torah. And, of course, every fool jumps right in there thinking that they're going to understand these secrets. Because the fool wants to forget about all the necessary preparation and the study. He just wants to jump into the big stuff. You know, let's get in there with God. You know what I mean? They can understand God. They know God's plans. They know the way God thinks. Everything. No problem. They're ready. Okay? That is the sign of the fool par excellence. But Nachmanides states over here, he says, now I want to tell you something. He says, when I bring in these writings, I talk about the hidden parts of Torah, you know, the mysteries of Torah. He says, I want to tell the reader a very important thing about these mysteries. He says, anyone that looks into this sefer and he finds the mysteries that I am writing, says, I want to tell him in truth that he will not understand my words and they will not be known to him at all with any kind of knowledge or understanding unless he has received the knowledge from a person who is a true individual that has received the true tradition from another person going all the way back to Sinai. And trying to figure it out and using your own intellect is simply a foolish thing and a waste of time. Okay? And he goes on to say that if a person tries to figure out these secrets, he says he will only evil will befall him, because they will speak against God in a way that they will not be subject to any kind of atonement. Okay? And then he says, and he quotes the Torah, that in the case of Sinai, it says where God told Moses to tell the people that they should not break forth to see God, meaning to say they should not go beyond. It doesn't mean in a physical sense, it means in an intellectual sense. They should not try to comprehend God beyond their abilities. Okay? And he says, because our God is a God of fire, a consuming fire, which means to say, consuming fire means that if you get too close, you get burnt, which means to say a person has to beware. A person has to think, am I ready for this? And if he jumps in too quickly, he gets burnt, gets consumed. Okay? So he says that what that person should do, the person who did not have a received tradition from man to man, face to face, from going back an authentic tradition, if they did not receive any training at all in this area, and they know nothing about it, on their own, they're never going to get it. And if they try to get it, they're just going to go away from God. So he says that these people should take, and that's all of us today, because there's no one, this tradition does not exist anymore. He says that all of us should take a Musar. Musar means, an ethical lesson from our holy rabbis when they say you should not try to study something, to search for something when it's too big. And something which is too strong, don't try to investigate it. And something which is out of sight intellectually, don't try to understand it. And he quotes, he repeats it several times. It has different forms. And it's repeated several times. And the concluding one is, you should not have anything to do with mysteries. Don't get involved in mysteries. Okay? Now, this is Nachmanides, who everyone knows is called the head of the Mekubalim, the head of the Kabbalists. Okay? So, I think it's quite clear that the Kabbalah that Nachmanides is referring to has nothing to do with the Kabbalah that people are talking about today. The Kabbalah people are talking about today is pure idolatry. It is pure primitivism. Nothing to do with Torah. And the people that espouse it cannot explain to you the one area in Talmud. They could not. They do not have the ability. They don't have the scholarship. And it's completely fraudulent. But let me get back to the point I mentioned before, and that is, I said in the beginning of this class, I said that I'm going to show you that there cannot be anything written down. But you'll say to me, well, look, Nachmanides has things written down, and Maimonides wrote things down, even though Maimonides says he didn't receive it from from person to person. He never received it, but he says, he says he's basing it upon his knowledge of philosophy, and he says he's not 100% sure that this is what the verses mean in the prophets, because man is only human, and he could be making a mistake. But he nevertheless wrote it down. He has things written there. The answer is very simple. The answer is that anything that anyone wrote down, like Nachmanides, he states clearly beforehand, you will not be able to figure it out from the written word. Okay? You see, the prohibition of writing something down means to write it down in a way. When I say something is in writing, it means the writing has some value, some communicative value. If I write something down to you and you can't understand it, is that called written? It's nothing. It's zero. Okay? Nachmanides explains that which he wrote in his explanation of the Torah, okay, his pirush, his explanation, he says, is not subject to understanding by anyone unless they heard it from person to person. They heard it by person, by way of tradition, from an authentic individual who truly knows and understands the Kabbalah, and he has transmitted it to this other individual. Then when that person reads his writings, he'll know, when he sees the reference, he'll know what it means. okay? It'll expand on his knowledge. It'll give him a little something, a little more to think about. But someone who doesn't know will not be able to figure out a word, which means to say, as I said before, Nachmanides knew the same thing as Maimonides, which is a Mishnah and a piece of Talmud, and no one disagrees with it. This is totally authentic, that this was strictly prohibited. To put anything in writing that is communicable is the strongest prohibition. And anyone that finds, so what I say is as follows, that first of all, there cannot be anything in writing. Secondly, if you say, you show me something like, well, from Nachmanides, which is in writing, I say to you that the person who wrote that down wrote it down in a way that it's unintelligible except by a person who has that knowledge from man, from person to person back to Sinai. And since there's no one like that today, then everything today remains, insofar as a written communicable message, it's worthless. Zero. Therefore, Kabbalah today simply does not exist. It is non-existent, and this is by the statements of the greatest scholars of Torah, both Maimonides, who maintained there is no tradition at all in existence, and even Nachmanides, who maintained that he did have a certain tradition. He himself admits, that there cannot be anything in writing, because that's basically a Mishnah and it's a Talmud, and no one can argue on that. Okay, so anyone that tells you otherwise is simply trying to deceive you. Okay. I think we'll stop here unless you have some questions.
I think that's a good place to stop because we've got about 1 minute left, so that'll make a nice little tape. And so we'll go from there.
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right.